Good morning. It's 8 o'clock. You're listening to KVNF Mountain Grown Community Radio. This is regional news for the Western Slope. I'm Travis Bubenik. Last Sunday's mining accident near Ouray was one of the worst in recent Colorado history. Two miners died and nearly two dozen were injured. More details about what happened are starting to come out. Telluride Watch reporter Samantha Wright has been covering the accident, and Aspen Public Radio's Elise Thatcher talked to Wright about the details of what exactly happened at the mine.
It sounds like the two deceased miners, Nick Capano and his supervisor, Rick Williams, had gotten into a portion of the mine where there was lethal levels of carbon monoxide gas. Nick Capano, who was a young, inexperienced miner, he had just started working there a couple of weeks ago, he succumbed to the gas, and Williams discovered him and tried to save him, but also succumbed. And when other miners in the area discovered the two, they attempted a rescue, but ultimately were not successful.
And when you say succumbed, are you saying passed out or died, passed away?
They died. They both died.
And then the other miners were trying to carry them out?
Yes. From what I understand, they were using the air hoses on their pneumatic drills to try to clear the air. They were able to get to the two of them, and Rick Williams at the time was actually still alive when the other miners found them. They weren't sure if Capano was alive, and they tried to drag him away from the area with the bad air, realized that it was too late, that he was dead, and they went back for Williams, and by that time, Williams had also died.
What do we know about how things were run there? I understand it was opened pretty recently.
Yes, Star Mine acquired the property in late 2011. At that time, the property had not been active for some time. There had been efforts over the years to get it going again, but the last time anyone was in there was a decade or two ago. So they had a big project on their hands to rehabilitate the mine and bring it back into production. They actually hired a lot of very skilled and experienced miners from Ouray and Silverton, people who had worked in the mines for years before the mines shut down in the 80s and 90s. So I think they had a very skilled team, but there have been some revelations that have come out since this accident happened that there was a concern about the safety of the operation up there.
A concern by workers there, or?
Yes, there have been four miners since March who had complained to MSHA about safety conditions at the mine and just some concern in the community, more on a scuttlebutt level, that it wasn't necessarily the safest place to work.
I can imagine that there are strict protocols that miners are taught to follow in a situation like the one that you're describing. Do we know whether they were following those protocols or if there was some lack of information or training for everyone to get out safely?
All miners are required to carry self-rescue devices, to have them on their person or near their person at all times when they're underground. And it has been confirmed that all of the miners involved in this tragedy did have their self-rescue devices. It doesn't sound like they actually used them. From what I understand, they had been trained to only use their self-rescue devices if they saw smoke. And of course, carbon monoxide is an invisible gas. There was no smoke in the area.
Well, Samantha Wright, thanks for taking the time to talk with us.
You're very welcome.
That report comes to us from Rocky Mountain Community Radio. Samantha Wright is a reporter with the Telluride Watch newspapers. She spoke with Aspen Public Radio's Elise Thatcher. And since the mine accident, a memorial fund has been set up to take donations for the family of Nick Capano, one of the two men killed. Information on that fund is available through Alpine Bank in Montrose. A 23-year-old Ouray woman who went missing on Wednesday was found dead yesterday morning. Ouray News reports Zena Lair was found shortly after police issued an emergency search alert for her on Thursday morning. Ouray Police Chief Justin Perry said his department received a missing persons report around 10 p.m. on Wednesday. Lair had reportedly failed to return after setting out on a hike by herself. While five state lawmakers and three of Colorado's biggest oil and gas producers say they're happy with new air quality rules, some small and mid-sized companies are worried the new regulations may be too costly. As the Denver Post reports, it's estimated complying could cost companies around $300 per ton of pollution. The Post reports that yesterday state regulators began diving into the details of the new rules, which seek to cut air pollution by over 100,000 tons a year. Earlier this week, around 30 representatives from area environmental groups told the Air Quality Control Commission they support that effort. Under the rules, oil and gas companies would have to do monthly inspections for leaks and repair damages within 15 days. Companies also wouldn't be allowed to vent methane into the atmosphere except for in emergencies. According to the Post, the rules call for about 95% of emissions from storage tanks, wells, and other facilities to be captured. Those rules are set to be finalized at hearings in February with state oil and gas commissioners. And according to the Aspen Times, the identity of the person killed in a plane crash near Cedar Edge on Tuesday won't be released until the Delta County coroner receives the results of pathology tests. That name could be out sometime today. The plane, a Cessna single engine, was flying from California to Aspen when it went down in a neighborhood north of Cedar Edge on Tuesday around 6 p.m. You're listening to KVNF Mountain Grown Community Radio. Stay tuned for the latest episode of Western Slope Skies from the Black Canyon Astronomical Society. Today we'll learn about the two Galileos, the man and the machine, and the moons of Jupiter. Following Western Slope Skies is the weekly KVNF Sports Report. For KVNF News, I'm Travis Bubinick.
In 1610, Galileo Galilei became the first person to observe another planet, Jupiter, and its four largest moons, Callisto, Europa, Ganymede, and Io. For the next 380 years, most scientists believed that these moons were similar to our moon, that is, rocky spheres without activity or atmosphere. As technology improved, theories emerged that perhaps the moons of other planets, especially Jupiter and Saturn, were much more interesting than our moon. In 1989, NASA launched the Galileo mission to Jupiter to evaluate these theories. Arriving in 1995, Galileo's observations have changed how we view the moons of other planets. Images show remarkably different surfaces on the four major moons with striking colors. Interestingly, the visual camera on Galileo was one of the first astronomical applications of CCD technology. The sensor was 800 pixels by 800 pixels. Today's smartphones far surpass this. Other data captured by Galileo provided strong evidence that Europa has a liquid ocean beneath its icy surface. Ganymede and Callisto also have saltwater regions beneath their surfaces. Io has very active volcanoes, which indicate a partially molten mantle. Ganymede has a strong magnetic field, the first for a moon. Europa, Ganymede, and Callisto have thin atmospheres. There are 67 confirmed moons of Jupiter. Most of them are dead, inactive rocks. To avoid possible contamination of the moons, in 2003, Galileo was deliberately navigated into Jupiter's thick atmosphere at 108,000 miles per hour, where it vaporized. In 1996, the U.S. and Europe launched Cassini-Huygens. The mission? To study Saturn and the major moons of Saturn. Cassini's discoveries have paralleled the Galileo mission in that the major moons of Saturn have proven to be intriguing beyond anyone's imagination. You have been listening to Western Slope Skies, produced by members of the Black Canyon Astronomical Society. I'm Brian Cashin.
Greetings. This is Eric Gould with your KVNF Regional Sports Report for Friday, November 22nd. For the first time since 1962, the Paonia Eagles will play for the 1A State Football Championship. Paonia won its semifinal matchup last week, 28-14, against previously unbeaten Buena Vista to advance to tomorrow's championship game. The Eagles got four touchdown runs from sophomore sensation Taylor Walters, and senior Will Austin ran for 252 yards in the big semifinal win. Paonia traveled to Buena Vista and beat the number one team in the state behind yet another stellar effort from both its offense and defense. Paonia's opponent in the championship game is a familiar one. Centauri, out of the Southern Peaks Conference, has won 10 games in a row, a streak that started with a victory over Paonia in Week 3. Centauri defeated another unbeaten team, second-ranked Lyman, 21-8 last week, to advance to tomorrow's championship game. The Eagles and Falcons are mirror images of each other, especially on defense. Centauri has allowed the least points all year, 101, while Paonia has allowed the second least points all year at 131. In the Week 3 matchup that saw Centauri win 27-14 in Paonia, the Falcons got a touchdown punt return from senior standout Jason Burr. Quarterback KC Jarvis torched the Eagles for 229 passing yards and two touchdowns, and Jarib Aziz was a force at running back and linebacker all year for the Falcons. The 1A state title game will be at Paonia Town Park tomorrow at 1 p.m. Extra bleachers were moved from the rodeo grounds to Town Park to accommodate what is expected to be a huge crowd. Get your seats early and dress warmly, as colder temperatures are expected at game time. Delta County will see a second playoff game tomorrow at 1 p.m. when the underdog Delta Panthers entertain the defending state champs, Silver Creek. Delta advanced to the 3A semifinal matchup after a tough 13-9 win in Glenwood Springs last week. Cordell Stroud made a game-saving tackle on fourth and goal on the last play of the game to send Delta to tomorrow's semifinal. Delta is led by quarterback Cade Gafford, receiver Ryan Whiteside, and running back Johnny Ponce. All three benefit from playing behind an athletic, talented Delta offensive line. The Panthers will face their toughest challenge yet in the defending champion Raptors. Silver Creek lost in the state finals 2 years ago, then upset Rifle last year 32-15 to win state. Silver Creek, out of Longmont, hopes to get its third state title game in a row behind an offense that has scored 436 points this season. Finally, Montrose, the number one team in 4A, goes on the road for the first time this postseason when they travel to Pueblo South tomorrow at 1 p.m. for a semifinal matchup against the Colts. Montrose advanced after last week's 47-27 victory over Denver South. Angelo Youngren ran for 120 yards, scored three times, and threw a touchdown pass to Ira Wooten in the Indians' win. Fullback Mike Rocha had 74 rushing yards and two more scores for Montrose. Quarterback Cameron DeVincentis threw a touchdown pass to Peter Shearer to complete the scoring explosion by Montrose. With a win tomorrow, the Indians will advance to the 4A state championship game next week. And that concludes your KVNF Regional Sports Report for Friday. This is Eric Gould saying congratulations to all three teams in our listening area for getting this far, and good luck tomorrow. Stay tuned to KVNF Mountain Grown Community Radio for future sports reports, and thanks so much for listening.